The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to What About Wealth? Making it, investing it, protecting it, leaving a legacy with your hosts, Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. In today's economy, preserving wealth has become more important than ever, especially when it comes to our future generations. Now, here is Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee.
Good morning, everyone. This is Rich Bloomfield. I'm coming to you today from beautiful Alpine, Utah.
And this is Rick Durfee. I'm the lawyer here in sunny Arizona, where it's cresting over 100 degrees every day.
I'm the CPA, or certified public accountant, for those of you who are not familiar with the term.
Yeah, and I'm the lawyer.
So we work together, Rick, have worked together for a lot of years. And we do that because working together, our clients get a much better outcome than if we don't. So we like it that way. And our clients so far like it that way.
We do. You know, I tell people all the time, if your lawyer and your CPA ever give you conflicting advice, one of them doesn't know all the facts. And if you share all the facts between them, they're going to come to a concurrence most of the time.
Most of the time.
Or they'll have a private little get-together where they can hash out their differences and then come back and give you a concurring recommendation.
That's true. So reminder that you can reach us at – we have our website at www.whataboutwealth.com. You can also call us, A New Thought in Today's World, at 480-324-8000. And you can listen to our shows right here on Voice America. And Rick, where else are we?
And on YouTube. You can find us on YouTube. We're out there. Just Google What About Wealth and you'll find us. We also want to encourage you, anybody who emails us at info@whataboutwealth.com after today's show, we are going to give you a free copy of my article, Why All Trusts Are Not Created Equal, which it's been published in multiple places. It's a fun article. It kind of hammers the trust and talks about some of the differences between various trusts. So if you email us at info@whataboutwealth.com, the article is yours for free.
Great. We're excited about today's show, Rick, and that's why we're giving away that article, actually, because we're going to be talking about myths about trusts, and there are a lot of them, and we're going to talk about them, debunk them, and I think it'll be a very interesting show because people are just confused about trusts, just kind of in general, and we're not surprised because there's a lot of stuff out there about them. But first, Rick, let's hear about this week's news that may affect your wealth.
Oh, there's some good stuff. Thanks, Rich. And I am excited about this week's topic. But in our news, one of the really interesting things, marriage rates have fallen 5% during the recession and are now at an all-time historic low. For the average U.S. male, when they marry, their age of marriage is now approaching 30 and is already 30 for many urban areas. And the fathers of unwed daughters who would like to be married are very aware of that trend, that the trend for marrying is getting older and older, which has a lot of huge effects on your wealth. And in particular, marriage is, or the lack thereof, is probably the single best predictor of poverty. Children born to unmarried parents are almost certain to live below the poverty line. If we encourage marriage, we're encouraging wealth. If we're encouraging non-marital relationships, we're encouraging poverty. And kind of a related statistic, last year, the number of children in the U.S. born to unwed parents now exceeds 50%. So this whole marriage thing and what the whole social debate about what is marriage and what we should permit or encourage by the law has huge economic consequences. It's often spoken about in other terms without any regard to what effect it has on our wealth, but the consequences for our wealth are pretty significant for the marriage debate.
Right. So listen up, Congress. If you're trying, and the President, if we're trying to turn the economy around, this might be one thing to encourage. So you're right. It's often they try to put it in a different bucket, but unfortunately, the statistics bear out that it has huge impacts. One other thing that has huge impacts, Rick, is the creation of wealth in the U.S. is rooted in the entrepreneur. So for most of our history, the U.S. has outpaced other countries for the number of businesses started. But a new study recently from Barclays, it's called The Origins and Legacy, The Changing Order of Wealth Creation. Yeah, a very interesting study. It finds that developing countries lead the U.S. in the creation of wealth by business startups. So worldwide, Rick, nearly 40% of millionaires cited a business startup as the source of their wealth. And in the U.S., the number is only 21%. The Pacific Rim comes in at 57%, Latin America at 58%. South Africa tops the list at 68%. So the Kauffman Foundation did a study that found we had 514,000 new business owners a month in 2012, which is down from 543,000 in 2011. So that 2012 marks the lowest number in 5 years. And the Hudson Institute found that startup companies added 2.34 million jobs in 2012. That compares to an average of about 3 million jobs a year from startups dating clear back to the 70s. Wow. So another reason, if I can just add some commentary here, we were talking about this before the show. If you put a target on somebody's back for creating wealth, which we've successfully done, or our politicians have successfully done, then people aren't going to do it anymore. So if you kind of wonder why these numbers are like they are, look at the laws and look at the tax laws that we have and the regulations that we have that make it so difficult, and then you don't have to wonder anymore.
You know, we can tell how the economy is doing by the flow of business comes in the front doors, frankly. And there are times when startup companies, the entrepreneurs, just a stream in the door on a regular basis. And that has not been the case for the last 6 years. They've been significantly in decline. We see people in a hunker down mode. And flippant remark I made before the show, if you tell people, hey, becoming wealthy and starting a business and making money is a bad thing, you are a bad person. You do that, we're going to spank you hard, which is kind of the message we're getting out there, that people aren't going to do it. So I don't know why we should be surprised. Now, kind of interesting to look at the attitudes about wealth, and which is significantly tied to taxation. It's been the progressive dream to tax income. The income tax has an interesting history in the U.S., but the G8 summit, which is currently underway, where leaders from the world's 8 wealthiest countries gather is now focusing its attention on these multinational companies that exploit differences in tax laws from one country to another to reduce their tax liabilities. And, you know, when countries have high tax rates, maybe even we could call them confiscatory tax rates, companies that operate in more than one country have been able to structure their businesses in such a way that they can shift revenue from the high tax country to the low tax country, resulting in a reduced tax rate. And this is done by all the big multinational companies. You think of any brand name, I'm not going to say any of them, our listeners know who they are, but you think of any brand name, a company, and they do this. And the practices come under criticism as these high tax rate countries see businesses and the resulting tax revenues flee their borders. And curiously, some of the biggest complainers, like Britain, are also some of the biggest facilitators of this practice, because Britain's protectorates, like the British Virgin Islands, are you know, some of the world's premier places for these so-called tax havens to reduce the tax liability. And I'm just remembering, I'm going to badly paraphrase something I heard Ronald Reagan say clear back in the 70s, you can tell which countries are doing a good job by which way the people run. You know, you don't have to build. In fact, I think this was in his famous Berlin Wall, tear this wall down, Mr. Gorbachev speech. You don't have to build walls to keep people in if you're doing a good job of governing. And when the people who make the wealth flee your country, that should be telling you something. That should be a message that is meaningful. And you know, curiously, we're debating, do we build a wall to keep people out? So even though we like to complain about how things are, there's still people who want to come here. But now, curiously, they want to come here not because they can. The American dream has shifted from I'll come to America and start a business and get wealthy. Now it's I'll come to America and get free health care and get food stamps, and I can take my children to the emergency room and somebody else will cover all the costs of their medical needs, and I can live off of somebody else's hard work. So the American dream is kind of shifting there. Anyway,
that's true. One last piece that will affect your wealth is that President Obama is planning a trip to Africa, and the estimated cost of the trip is around $100 million. So if you wonder, you know, we've got people in the government jobs that are being sequestered. Their income has been cut by 20% because they work 4 days a week instead of five. But anyway, but he can afford $100 million trip to Africa. So think about that one. You know, if we don't wake up in America and start making noise about this silliness that's going in Washington, it'll probably just continue. So we encourage all of our listeners, be active in the political process, even if it's just writing your representative or your senator, because until we say enough is enough, this nonsense is going to continue, I'm afraid. So.
Okay.
That's the political commentary for today, Rick.
Ta-da-da. We'll leave that for our quote of the week, which might be more political commentary. We actually have two quotes this time, which we found two really good ones that are just too good to pass up. So the first one I'll share is from Rick Warren, who said, and I love this. Let me state the quote exactly, and then I'll reserve my commentary for the end. But our culture has accepted two huge lies. The first is that if you disagree with someone's lifestyle, you must fear or hate them. The second is that to love someone means you agree with everything they believe or do. Both are nonsense. You don't have to compromise convictions to be compassionate. I love the idea that you can be compassionate for someone that you disagree with. You can tolerate someone even if you believe their behavior is wrong. And tolerance does not mean that you have to say, my bad behavior is okay. Tolerance means that your behavior is bad and the choices that you're making are going to lead to great unhappiness in your life, but you have the right to make those choices if you want to. That's what tolerance means. Anyway, go ahead with your quote too, Rich. I love it, so bring it on.
All right, so after these recent revelations about how much information the government is collecting on each of us through the PRISM and program and other programs. And by the way, I live within, 5 or 6 miles of this huge data center in Utah that they keep talking about as though it was some sort of a surprise. They just found it out here in the desert. It's been under construction for years. But anyway, after we found out all that stuff that they're collecting about us, James Clapper, who is the director of national intelligence, was asked about his answer to Congress back in March, where he was asked, does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? To which he answered, no. So when he was asked about that on the news, I think it was this last Sunday or at least recently, he said, well, I responded in what I thought was the most truthful or least untruthful manner by saying no. So anyway,
but now,
that was an interesting quote.
A double speak way of saying I lied.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, kind of sounds that way. Okay, on those happy notes, let's come to our give back story. We love to have a give back story, and I found just the sweetest story that I wanted to share with our listeners. Laura Wellington was a runner in the Boston Marathon, and she was a half a mile from the finish line when the explosion went off. And you got to picture this. She had run a long ways. And she reported to more than one news outlet, and I want to read this because these are her words. At that moment, a couple walking by stopped. The woman took the space tent off her husband, who had finished the marathon, and wrapped it around me. She asked me if I was okay, if I knew where my family was. I reassured her I knew where they were, and I would be okay. The man then asked me if I finished, to which I nodded no. He then proceeded to take the medal off from around his neck and placed it around mine. He told me, you are a finisher in my eyes. I was barely able to choke out a thank you between my tears. Odds are I will never see this couple again, but I'm reaching out with a slim chance that I'll be able to express to them just what this gesture meant to me. Now that good Samaritan, so that's what she said. So now we know who this guy was. He's been identified by the Toronto Star. He's a 46-year-old man named Brent Cunningham from Sitka, Alaska. And he didn't even know people were looking for him. When somebody told him that they were out there looking for him, he didn't believe it. And when he heard on the day of the marathon that there had been an explosion, he thought they were joking, but then he and his wife started walking with his family and started passing runners who'd been stopped near the end of the race. And this is what he said. He said there were all these thousands of runners with their running bibs on, but none of them were wearing medals because they never finished. Many of them were at mile 25, 26, when all of a sudden they couldn't run anymore because of what happened. We were with a gal who was crying. She didn't finish the race, and I just feel so much compassion. I'm embarrassed to tell you this. I mean, I don't want any attention for it, but I just gave her my medal, my race medal, because I finished and got my medal, and she didn't finish, and she deserved a medal. And so I gave her my medal because here I had to. It was like, I cannot not give this to you. You deserve it. And she just started bawling. So that story just shows to me the depth of compassion that someone can have to see the tremendous sacrifice that a runner had made to get so close to the finish line and have it snatched away from them by a wicked and evil act. So that's our give back story for the day.
Yeah, so many people train for years and run to get in the Boston Marathon. So that really had to be a huge disappointment. And that's a great story, Rick. We need to go to break now, and but right after break, we'll come back, and we're going to get into myths about trust.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Live well and leave a legacy. Durfee Law Group offers dynasty estate planning and asset protection services so you can do just that. We focus on helping our clients gain maximum protection and privacy by providing the right tools and innovative strategies to sustain both immediate and long-term success. Call us today to set up a complimentary consultation. Call 480-324-8000. That's 480-324-8000. Or visit our website at www.durfeelawgroup.com. That's D-U-R-F-E-E lawgroup.com. We'll help you turn the gift of wealth into a blessing for your heirs rather than a curse.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
So, Rick, I don't know if people know this, but that music that we play at the beginning of the show in between segments, who actually played that?
That was me playing that. And that's my song, actually. So.
We've got a multi-talented attorney here. So I'm the CPA, and Rick is the attorney. And our topic, as we mentioned earlier, is myths about trust. And Rick, we've got lots and lots of those. So let's throw it over to you and start with the first myth about trust.
Well, you know, I'm going to begin with, I guess, a story. This week I had a new client come in, and they were very well prepared for their initial consultation. They had been thinking a great deal about what they wanted to do and how they wanted to handle things in their family, and they had a very detailed, in fact, quite elaborate scheme for what I call age-based distributions. They're going to give this much at this age and this much on this birthday and this much on this birthday. And I listened to this and I said, okay, yeah, great. We can do that if you want to. Tell me why you want to do this. And then they expressed all these concerns about how the wealth was going to affect their children and whether or not it would last and on with this big long list of concerns over how the money was going to be handled. And so I expressed to them, you know, it's usually helpful in making choices if you know what your options are. So let's explore some things. And we then looked at the idea of discretionary distributions, that they may or may not distribute the money, that there are guidelines, that there are values, statements of wishes, that there are incentives to do things. And we looked at this alternative distribution structure that's based on preserving the principal and using the money on an as-needed basis and even utilizing the money inside the trust without distributing it so that it's protected and the beneficiaries are provided for, but they don't just have the principal, the corpus, that they can go out and spend. And you know, the whole age-based distribution thing is kind of the state of the art, so to speak, in the industry out there. It's what most trusts do. It's what most planners think of as a way of stretching out the distribution. So the kids are going to blow it anyway, but at least they won't blow it all at once. And I just think that there's nothing about having a birthday that qualifies a person to be able to handle large amounts of money or to be in a position where they're qualified to make financial decisions. So we need to look at something else. So the first myth I want to blow out of the water is that age-based distributions are a good way to preserve wealth or prevent problems in the next generation. They're not. They create as many problems or more problems than they solve.
And the alternative to that, just so that everyone is clear, is I know you talked about it.
Yeah,
but I think
distributions should be discretionary. So you have they can either make distributions or not, and then we have defined some guidelines and some rules based on the values of the grantors. And we can have value-based expressions. We can have incentive-based expressions called statements of wishes and other rules. A huge question that people want to consider is, and I always ask this, do you want your heirs to consume the principal? And people often haven't thought about this, but if you receive an inheritance and you blow it, you consume it. You eat it. It's gone. Did we succeed or did we fail? And the bottom line is, if your heirs consume their inheritance, we've screwed up. We've done something terribly wrong. We need to think through what we want to have happen with this. And the bottom line is, there are mechanisms that we can employ, and these discretionary distributions are one of them, that instead of just dumping the money out of the trust and giving it to the kids, that will protect the money. Another thing, this is not on our list here, but I'm going to mention this, that people don't think through. You have an exemption from transfer taxes. When wealth moves from one generation to the next, it gets taxed, and there's an exemption from that, that if we – take that exemption, then we have this block of wealth that is not subject to transfer taxes. And that exemption from transfer taxes, this generation skip tax exclusion, is pretty cool. Utilizing that exemption makes it so that wealth can transfer over multiple generations and avoid multiple instances where it would otherwise be taxed. And just leaving the wealth in the trust and using it in the trust rather than taking it out of the trust makes that available. And it's something that is almost universally ignored. So here's another myth, that a trust is a single-use instrument. Its purpose is to avoid probate. That's its only purpose. Hand off the wealth to the next generation, and then the trust shuts down. And while that is the most common way in which a trust is employed, that is also a big, huge mistake. You're throwing away this fabulous opportunity to create a structure which will be exempt from transfer taxes that can be used over multiple generations. And to create anything that's going to last over multiple generations requires some long-term thinking. We have to look down the road and ask ourselves, well, what kind of things are going to come up? Because everybody in the room here will all be dead by the time this is being implemented. So what kind of tools can we hand off? How can we protect and empower and look forward? So I guess the other myth at this stage I want to debunk is that a trust is a single-use throwaway a device that once we've avoided probate, we're done, shut it down, get rid of it. That's not the case. You can use it for a long, long time to do a lot of really cool things.
And all of us actually, Rick, know about families that have done that and that continue to contribute to the world in positive ways. So, you know, some of the more famous ones, I think, are, you know, the Kennedy family, the Sam Walton's family, and I know that there are numerous other ones that have been around for generations that continue to contribute to society in ways that most people, just sort of take for granted now. But it really and it's the folks that have thought down the road a bit and have kept it in these trusts because they really are, as you said, really cool because we actually still have that opportunity to make them multi-generational. And not that Congress won't screw that up at some point. They keep talking about it. But right now, it's a very cool opportunity.
Well, I want to say, for Congress to screw that up, one thing has to happen. They have to think beyond the election cycle. And politicians are not inclined to do that. And one of the, this whole back to our news item before the break about the G8 looking at tax avoidance, for that to be effective, these countries have to think of the tax laws outside their own country, and they have to get other countries to do things, and that's never going to work. And for politicians to really screw up the long-term planning, they have to think beyond their own term of office, which is really, really tough for them to do, which is why we have some of the policies we do. But families, on the other hand, are not in that situation. If you are a family, if you are the leader of a family, you are the parent, the mother or the father, it is extremely appropriate for you to be asking the questions, what is the long-term direction that my family is going? What are the things I'm doing that's going to have long-term consequences with my children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren? Because they do. Your choices have consequences that outlive you. And that is especially true with wealth and the structures that we put in place. And so the single-use trust is a throwaway device. Is a bad idea. The trust can be and should be a long-term planning vehicle. So, Rick, I want to throw this next one over to you. A lot of people think that if they do a trust, it's going to really screw up their tax reporting and make their tax life complicated. So, myth. Here's a myth. Does a trust complicate your tax life?
Well, and the answer to that is probably – sort of depends on the trust, but because there are lots and lots of trusts out there, Rick, as you know.
That's the lawyer that does the weasel answer.
but no, typically it does not make your tax reporting difficult at all, and I'll tell you why. It's because a revocable trust, which is what most people think of as a trust, doesn't even file a tax return, doesn't have its own tax ID number. It really doesn't even exist for income tax purposes. So that doesn't really make your life difficult, and it doesn't have to file its own tax return. So that's another myth, is that it makes your life complicated and it has to file a tax return. So those are two myths right there that we can blow out of the water.
And we call those disregarded entities. It's just a non-entity for income tax reporting purposes.
Right. And then, Rick, another trust that we work with a lot, which is an irrevocable trust, or a technical term of an intentionally defective grantor trust, even those – unless you choose to, most of those, we file a tax return in the first year that we create it and inform the IRS that the grantor is going to be picking up any of the incidents of income taxation on their personal return. So even in that case, it's a one-time filing for most folks. And not that somewhere down the road, the trust won't start filing its own return, but typically for today, it's a myth. It's not something that complicates your life at all.
So let's circle back around with these and tackle some of these tax issues, because there are a lot of myths about trusts relating to taxes. And two, I hear often, oh, if I have a trust, my tax rate's going to go up. Or, oh, if I have a trust, that's a way for me to avoid taxes. My tax rates are going to go down. So both of those myths, tax rates go up with a trust or tax rates go down with a trust, tackle those for us.
Okay. So tax rates for trusts, as far as the actual brackets are concerned, are exactly the same as they are As far as the rates, they're the same, exactly the same as they are for individuals. Now, the width of the brackets in a trust are very, very small. So even though the rates are the same, the actual brackets are narrower, which means that you get to the higher rates quicker. So I guess if in talking about it in that context, they could be higher. That's why we do the election that I just spoke about, where we make the grantor trust taxable to the grantor. But then to say that tax rates for trusts are lower, that's also a myth, because as I just explained, the rates are exactly the same. And, both of those, are somewhat mythical, and you have to really understand what you're getting into there, because the rates are really neither higher nor lower, but the brackets are narrower. So
when my clients come in and say, "Oh, I'm here to get a trust so that I don't have to pay as much in income tax," they've been sadly misinformed.
That's right. They're dreaming about that one. So.
Dang! If only.
Right.
We'd have so much more business if we could help people pay less in income tax with a trust. It would just they'd blow the doors off. But it doesn't work that way. Another myth that we encounter, and this stems, I think, from the common word living. And I've actually had this asked three or four times in the last few months, which is why I put it on the list. Isn't a living trust and a living will the same thing? Don't those do the same thing? And the answer is they are categorically different. A living trust, which is a trust that is effective while you are alive, and the Latin term is an inter vivos trust, which means while living, is an instrument or a device that disposes of or manages property. A trust is essentially a device for the control and management of property, whereas a living will is a document which expresses your wishes concerning medical treatment at the end of life. So it is a document where we typically decline to have life-extending medical procedures that are going to keep us along when we're otherwise alive, when we're otherwise going to die. It's I call it the pull the plug document. So the pull the plug document, a living will, is not the same thing as a living trust, which administers your property.
Okay, so along that same line, Rick, I here's another myth that I hear all the time. If I have a trust, I don't need a will.
Yeah, that's a good one, because people rightly think, well, my trust is going to take care of everything, so what the heck do I need a will for? Now, fortunately, unless you really go to an incompetent person, most of the people out there that put together trusts will also provide you what's called a pour over will, which is a will that says, anything that's not in my trust, put it in my trust. And we want that because things happen in real life where sometimes we wanted or intended for our assets to be owned by our trust. But if they are not owned by our trust at the time of our death, then we need a device to get them there. And the pour over will does that. The pour over will simply says, take all my stuff that should have been in the trust while I was alive, and since it wasn't there, stick it in the trust. So the pour over will is there as kind of a safety net to catch anything that wasn't in the trust that should have been, and throw it in there.
All right. So if you have a trust, you still need a will. And the other thing, Rick, that people forget about in that scenario is that if you have minor children, the will is rather essential, because it's where we appoint guardians for minor children. I'm talking about legal stuff here, but
yeah,
I think
you are dead. You are spot on. So the minor child. You know, we've got to go to break. When we come back from break, we'll talk about whether A pour over will is the only device you need to fund your trust, or whether you need to do more than that. We'll talk about that after the break.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Live well and leave a legacy. Durfee Law Group offers dynasty estate planning and asset protection services so you can do just that. We focus on helping our clients gain maximum protection and privacy by providing the right tools and innovative strategies to sustain both immediate and long-term success. Call us today to set up a complimentary consultation. Call 480-324-8000. That's 480-324-8000. Or visit our website at www.durfeelawgroup.com. That's D-U-R-F-E-E lawgroup.com. We'll help you turn the gift of wealth into a blessing for your heirs rather than a curse.
Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business.
You are tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back. This is Rick. I'm the lawyer.
And this is Rich. I'm the CPA, and I'm talking over the lawyer, if you can believe it.
Oh, no. Yeah. This is What About Wealth. Today our topic is myths about trusts. And Rich, we're going to do our first listener question.
Okay, so we do have listeners, and sometimes they're clients that write in, so we protect their identity. And so we're going to this is a question from Trina from Nebraska, and here's the question. My revocable trust protects my assets, right?
I love that question. I always have a flippant answer to that, too. Yeah, your revocable trust will protect your assets, but you have to die first. And most of my clients are not willing to go that far. So absent a death, which causes a revocable trust to become irrevocable, a revocable trust does not protect your assets. So thinking that you have an asset protection plan because you have put together an estate planning trust and funded it is a deep, deep myth with sad, sad consequences. And it's amazing to me how pervasive that is. It's amazing to me how people can be my clients. They come to me because I told them this very thing, and then we spend an hour talking about it in their very specific case, and then a year later they come back to me and they say, now, my assets are protected because I have a trust, right? So even when this is as clearly spelled out as humanly possible, this misperception about trust is still very, very persistent.
Boy, it really is. And I hear it all the time. And I think, and that as you mentioned, it's very unfortunate, because if you've been around as long as you and I have, you've seen people that have thought that and have relied on that and have, at the end of the day, been very sad because their assets are gone, and in spite of having a trust, because a revocable trust just does not protect. An irrevocable trust, on the other hand, is actually very good at that. So,
and we should add, there are a number of states. In fact, it's the number is climbing. It's in the mid-teens now that have authorized or sanctioned variations of what's called a self-settled asset protection trust, where a person can put assets in the trust for their own benefit and protect them from creditors. And that is a device which I generally do not recommend, because I have seen it penetrated multiple times. So even in states that have these self-settled asset protection trusts, I think as asset protection goes, that is a weak and too readily frustrated approach. There are far more effective things to do for asset protection, but that's a different radio show. So I kind of want to get back to this issue about, if I have a pour over will, I don't need to worry about funding my trust. And there's kind of a related issue that, I don't want to fund my trust because my children are successor trustees. And if I fund my trust, I have to tell my children what I have. Now, this is a myth that kind of strikes close to home because it actually is something that happened to my grandfather. My grandfather was told by a lawyer when he set up his trust up in your state there, Rich, this was out of Utah. The lawyer told him that, well, if you fund your trust, and this was in writing, by the way, which blows my mind. If you fund your trust, you have to tell your children everything you have. Which the very idea of that traumatized my grandfather, who was very private and who didn't want all of his assets in great detail disclosed to anybody, especially his children. And so the lawyer then advised him that rather than funding your trust now, it will be better if you wait and rely upon your pour over will to have your assets go into your trust after you're dead. And at that point, you'll be dead, so you won't care. It'll be okay if your children find out about your assets. So I call this the big double dip. The lawyer charged my grandfather a lot of money. In fact, at that time, it was about six or seven times the amount that I charged to create a trust, which blew me away that he would charge that much. And then he charged almost double that much again when my grandfather passed away to do a probate. Because if you are relying upon your pour over will to fund your trust, it guarantees that you will have a probate, which is a public process in the courts. It's adversarial. It's litigation. It's extremely expensive, and it just guaranteed that it had to go through that process. And I was really furious at the time, and made some attempts which were ineffective to intervene in the process. But other family members besides me were in control of it, and I was not able to do anything about it at that point. But the lawyer ended up charging. I'll just throw some numbers out. But between the trust and the probate, it was all about $25,000, this was back in the – at a time when a trust, a fully funded trust for less than $2,000, my grandfather could have had a trust, could have completely funded it, could have completely avoided probate. So the total lawyer fees were 10 times. So, which I guess brings me to another myth. If I go to a lawyer, I'm always going to get exactly what I need. And sadly, that's not the case. And people have to, you know, in fairness, people pull this on me too. Well, Rick, you told me that if not all lawyers are going to do a good job, how do I know you're doing a good job? And that's a fair question. And I guess maybe listen to enough radio shows and go to enough seminars and read enough books that you can sort out who's going to do a good job and who's not. I suppose one thing you have to ask yourself is, do you agree with the philosophy and the outcome? I have had clients tell me, I like that age-based mandatory distribution thing that you talk against. And so I'm going to go use a lawyer that will help me do that, which is perfectly fine. So pick a lawyer that matches your philosophy.
Okay. So next question or next myth. I don't need a trust now because the exemption from estate taxes is so high. Wow. Heard that. I've heard that a few times lately.
Since the first of the year, I've heard that one probably a dozen times. That's tied to the idea that the purpose of the trust is to avoid estate taxes, which often that's not even why we're doing it. It's also tied to this idea, the myth that a trust is a single-use throwaway device. In fact, a trust has multiple purposes. Reducing or managing the estate taxes is only one of them. Obviously, a trust is also useful for preventing probate. Sometimes people think this is kind of another myth that we'll tackle at this in the same discussion here. Sometimes people think that probate and estate taxes are the same thing, and they're not. The estate taxes are a confiscation of property by the state or the federal government as it transfers from one person to another. And confiscation might be a little harsh word, but they take their piece. Uncle Sam gets his piece of the action when the property moves from one person to another. That's a tax. Probate is a legal proceeding under the court system to determine who is rightfully entitled to the property, and the trust, an effective estate planning trust, one of its functions is to avoid that probate. So avoiding probate is another function, functioning as a succession vehicle, managing what happens to the property after it's transferred to the next generation. Are we going to have a long-term multi-generation plan to preserve and protect wealth and to manage the consequences of wealth or not? So there are a lot of things. Are we doing asset protection after death? Are we protecting future generations from having the wealth confiscated by a bad marriage, a divorce, or substance abuse, or spendthrift situations, or family litigation? Are we trying to integrate family values into the plan? A lot of those issues are brought into a trust.
Okay. So another myth. I have a trust. If I have a trust, my estate planning is done.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. I recently at one of the places I speak had a gentleman come up to me, and he had a substantial estate north of $20 million. And he said, great, you do trusts. He says, I have a trust. My estate planning is all done. I have a trust. And I said, so you have a trust. That's all you have? And he was readily, in fact, quite enthusiastic, almost exuberant to say, yeah, and that because of that, my estate planning is done. And that is not the case. He was shocked and, in fact, rather flustered to hear that even with his trust, with a $20 million estate, he was still going to have estate taxes, that there were still things that could and should be done to avoid those taxes. And, you know, you have to look at everything that's going on, not just the amount of wealth, but also what's going on in your family. What kind of issues are there with children and grandchildren that we might need to anticipate and put in some appropriate planning devices to cover?
Right. So, I suppose that was a revocable trust that he had.
It was about a 12-page trust too. So for a $20 million estate, a 12-page trust is not adequate. So let's hit these last three myths real quick here.
Okay. One trust is as good as another.
Yeah, they're not. And if you want to know the details why, that's when email us at info@whataboutwealth.com. We'll send you the article, Why All Trusts Are Not Created Equal. And another one that I'll just say, to protect assets, a trust has to go offshore. And that is a huge, huge myth. Often we can do domestically, frankly, a better job of protecting assets through the use not only of a trust, but appropriate business entities put together in the right way. So sometimes going offshore actually creates more risk for your assets because it elevates the probability of that you'll get an audit or an adverse tax ruling by a taxing authority, it certainly increases your compliance costs. And there are some highly effective domestic things that can be done to protect assets so you do not have to go offshore. Now, Rich, we have a philosophical problem. Ask that question, and we'll talk about that, and that'll be our last myth we'll tackle.
Okay, so a trust is an entity or is not an entity. Which is it?
Yeah, what this entity thing. The it used to be that lawyers actually would debate this, and there were big volumes, restatements of trusts, which are multi-volume documents, which look at the law over all these jurisdictions. It used to be there were many pages, tens, hundreds of pages even devoted to the idea, is a trust an entity or is it not? And lawyers would argue this. And I think this argument has been settled by the IRS. And it was settled when the IRS started issuing tax ID numbers for trusts. And I think technically that's the dividing line when a trust becomes an entity. So a revocable trust, as long as it is a disregarded entity and all the taxes are reported under the social security numbers of the grantors, is probably not an entity. It's just disregarded. It's out there. It's a piece of paper. It's a contract that controls. That's the music we got to go. But once you get a tax ID number, you're an entity. So we're done. Rich, want to close up?
Yeah, I just want to remind our listeners about next week's show. We're going to have Dana Allison, who heads up the Worldwide Women's Health Initiative. She'll be joining us from London. We're looking forward to that show. And so call us if you have questions about trusts. We hope we've debunked the myths today, and we'll see you next week on What About Wealth?
For listening to What About Wealth with hosts Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. Please join us again for another edition next Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Until then, have a profitable week.